Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play, which gives you access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a 3-month plan and an annual plan. You'll have access to incredible shows available only on Gaia, like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space, and much, much more. Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Let's start the show.
Their party people, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, it's me. It's Cam Hale, and as always, sitting across from me, who has been fiddling with buttons nonstop for the last half hour, es mi amigo the Philly, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm here, stressed out in studio, Skeleton Studios. Yeah, if you've been keeping up with us on social media, you could see we got a new gadget in the mail this week. And I'm no audio engineer, so it's been taking me a while to try to figure out all the new buttons on this one because it's completely different than the one we were using before.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're hearing right now is not the new one. This is still the standard one that we've been using for a couple years now. But yeah, so we're trying to upgrade things constantly every once in a while, just like everything else, you know, with computers or anything you need to upgrade. So the new one that I got was the DBX1066 compressor limiter gate. And the current one we use is like a Behringy Multicom Pro XL 4600 or something.
Here he goes. I like to come over here and sit while he's adjusting it and ask questions that I know he doesn't know the answers to.
No, it's just a crazy console, a bunch of lights. I just turn knobs and press buttons till it sounds good. Because, you know, they have all these technical jargon. I'm like, just say that it turns the microphone off and on. That's all it needs to say.
We've got this book, folks. You can hear me thrumming through it of all these pages, and you can read stuff on here. I'm looking at it now. I have no idea what that means. None. So yeah, we may have to reach out to Tim, get him to come back by and help us out again or something along those lines.
Well, I was quite proud of myself the last time because he came over here and checked it out and was like, man, yeah, it looks great. I'm like, yes, looks great.
I don't know if we can catch lightning in a bottle twice.
Well, that's why I'm glad we have the old one, because if this one something goes wrong, I can always just plug a few wires and go right back to the recording.
Exactly.
I mean, this is like the second time you've been to the studio and you're like, did you get the new one working? I'm like, no, I still hadn't even hardly jacked with it. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around on
kind of
what
afraid.
All these buttons are.
I'm kind of afraid. Hey, how did it all go this weekend?
We lost. Well, we're not out of the tournament yet. We have another game tomorrow night. But we did lose our first game, so it was kind of tough.
But they played well. They played,
yeah, they
real
played
good.
Well. You know,
it's just good teams. It's a tournament traveling tournament teams.
Mm. Right. That's what I had to tell Jacob. You know, you have to understand when you make the all star teams and you move on, you're playing other cities' all star teams as well.
Exactly.
So they're handpicked too. So, you know, you're not gonna play against somebody that doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah. You don't get to just beat up on kids that don't really want to play.
So if you want to know the truth, we hit well. We played defensively pretty well. What really came down to is, for whatever reason, our pitching really wasn't on Saturday. Just all our pitchers seemed to struggle, and our catchers, they were struggling too. There was too many balls that they should have caught that they didn't. And man, when those balls getting wild, the kids start scoring. And once it starts happening and everybody kind of gets their head down, I mean, it's pretty much over.
It's a snowball effect. It's hard to get the youngins to fight through that.
Yeah, but we'll be back. Like I said, we got another game. We would have had a game on Sunday if we had won the game on Saturday, but since we lost on Saturday, our game got moved to Monday. So when you're hearing this, folks, tonight we'll be playing again. But yeah, it was a good time. Hey, look, it's summertime. The weather was perfect. It was beautiful.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm sitting outside eating popcorn in the breeze, watching a baseball game. It was perfect. Then
can't
we went to Babe's
that.
Afterwards. Got me some chicken and
you're
stuff
right.
like that.
It was, can't hate on that.
It's a pretty
That's
good day.
Good.
I came home.
Yeah.
And what did I do yesterday afternoon after we
Fights.
Got home? Well, before that, I watched Luke swim in the pool in the backyard and grilled out some stuff. And then the fight started. And then the IRL race started. And then when that was over... we decided to have a marathon of Michael Jackson songs while I watched Luke perform in front of me in the living room.
So. I know he loves the song Thriller.
Well, he was just running around in the studio film a few minutes ago in a singlet.
Had a wrestling singlet on.
I guess DeLee was coming by to drop something off. All of a sudden he comes in here, hey, what's going on? You know, he's got this singlet
wrestling
on.
Wrestling
singlet. What the heck's he talking
on.
About? Some robot he's going to cut his head off with a sword? Did you hear him?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Michael, I don't know what he's talking about.
But he had his wrestling singlet on and he was showing me his wrestling stance. It was greatness.
He's got one of the old bruds, the big brud used to be little bruds, and they were on the Weatherford wrestling team.
The Pee Wee wrestling team, yeah.
So he's got a Weatherford Kangaroos wrestling singlet. But now it's not, it's still a little big on him, but
yeah.
And he's got two of them, so he loves it.
Yeah, he'll fill them out. He'll fill them out. It might take him a while, but he'll fill them out.
Well, let's get into the news, folks. Did you check this out? I know several people have sent this, not just this article, but the new article, and Beth Arzee sent it to me first, about they just found another... finding where it showed that humans were around 300,000 years ago.
Yep.
This is pretty cool. This is along the same lines. This is a mask that is among one of the oldest human-made metal objects they've ever found in South America. It says this ancient rectangular copper mask recently found in the southern Andes in Argentina is around 3,000 years old, and it's one of the oldest human-made metal objects from South America, and its discovery challenges the accepted idea that South American metalworking originated in Peru, according to archaeologists. Found at the site were adults and children's where they were buried. The mask dates to approximately 1000 BC, and the scientists wrote in a study describing the find. It says holes mark the position of the mask's eyes, nose, and mouth, with additional small circular openings near the edges that could have been threaded to secure it to the face or an object. Sources of the copper ore have been found within 44 miles or 70 kilometers of the location where the mask was uncovered, suggesting that it was produced locally. It is therefore within high probability that metalworking emerged in Argentina at the same time that it was developing in Peru. It said gold objects estimated to be nearly 4,000 years old have been found in southern Peru, according to a study published in February 2008 in the Journal of Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
I just got that in.
Yeah. Bronze artifacts dating to around 1000 AD were previously found in the Peruvian Andes, though it is difficult for experts to say for sure if the objects originated where they were found or if trade had brought them there. Whether during the summer or rainy seasons exposed the metal mask, they say, along with a collection of human bones in a tomb near the village of La Quebrada in northwestern Argentina, the study authors wrote. Now, it says there were about 14 bodies found in the burial area with the bones all mixed together, and the mask was placed on top of one in the corner of a pile. It says nearby there was a second burial that held a single occupant, the bones of a child approximately 8 to 12 years old, also dating to around 3,000 years ago, were buried with a stone bead necklace that appeared to be also accompanied with a copper pendant, perforated by a small hole near the top. This mask that they found measures about 7 inches long and nearly 6 inches wide. It says impurities in the copper are lower than 1%. They said in order to create a mask, someone would have had to have hammered the metal flat while it was cold and then reheated it, according to these researchers. It says the age these metal objects, particularly the mask crafted, deliberately resembles the human face, strongly suggests that people in the Argentinian regions of the Andes were shaping copper into artifacts much, much earlier than previously thought. So, I guess for a long time they thought that metallurgy developed in Peru first, and it wasn't until much later that Argentina developed metallurgy. But apparently that's not so now. They found these masks, and they know that they were working with copper. Now, one of the problems, and the article even brings it up, is just because they found it there, does it necessarily mean it was made there?
It doesn't mean it was made there, no.
Right? Or was it traded, and it came from somewhere else? I mean, we've talked about on the show, they were mining copper ore in the Iroy up in Michigan, Lake Michigan, 14,000 years ago. Yeah. And the Minoans were bringing it back to the Middle East. I'm sure there was, I mean, that's the thing, is there were established trade routes even back then, and I think that the mask could have come from in just about anywhere.
They could have.
But still, very interesting.
It could have, yeah, it could. It's, that's the thing, is like we've always said, is the only way that they know certain things is they have to try to tie it to it. If there's nothing to say that it was made or even altered there, you know, where it uses something along the lines of like maybe it's got some of their writing on it or something. If it's just a mask, then you're right, is it could be from anywhere.
And if you look at this mask, it's pretty cool. It's kind of because it's green because of
the patina on it.
And everything. It's pretty cool. It's a ceremonial mask. They don't know what it was used for. Maybe a dance. Maybe there was a burial mask. They don't know.
Yeah.
But it is pretty cool.
Well, I've got something here that's pretty cool. And it was brought to my attention by Miss Rose. She sent this to us here on the quick email because of me talking about going to Las Vegas. And this is a thing from MUFON. And it actually took place on the 4th of this month, this year, at the Palazzo Hotel in Las Vegas. It says a human-like alien was spotted in Las Vegas, okay? Now, get a load of this. This is the appearance of these aliens that was first given. You're going to enjoy this whole story. There was a male alien around 6.5 to 7 foot tall, blonde, thin, and very well dressed in perhaps a charcoal suit. The person said he was always looking down. I try hard to look at him, but couldn't focus in on him for some reason. The hair was to the collar, seemed to be one length as opposed to a shaved cut. Now, the female was a few inches shorter, and she was wearing heels. She was thin.
Now, who is this that saw these?
This is a person reporting on this.
Well, how did they know they were aliens?
Well, I'll get to that. Just listen to this. Just you're jumping ahead of the story. You're like my wife. Hold on.
I've seen some strange people before, like in the supermarket. Yeah. Maybe those are aliens.
Well, so far what they're describing isn't odd in Vegas. From what I saw, everything this seems to be right on point.
Did you see any aliens while you were in Vegas?
I'm quite sure of it. Yes, I'm quite sure of it. Now, it says the female had long, very red hair. Now, this person said it was obviously dyed red or it was a wig, but it was very straight and it was all the way down her back. And she said that the female also had bangs. Said I wanted to see her eyes and did, and that they were bluish, and the pigmentation was very unique, and that she wore a long black jacket over what this person's believed to be a dark blue dress. Says, but I do not remember seeing a handbag. Now, here's the interaction, I guess, that give this person the idea. Says, after watching the first half of the NBA Finals in our room, my sister and I decided to go downstairs to watch the second half of the game at the Grand Lux Casino Cafe Bar, which is the back end of the casino, and it was a pretty quiet area. There was only a very few people around. Said we both noticed a strikingly tall couple about 15 feet to our left, walking towards us. We stopped, planning on letting the two walk in front of us so we could get a good look, because something just did not seem right about them. But that's not what happened. Unknowingly, I must have taken a few steps forward as if to step in front of them, which was not my intent at all. They were not even within my peripheral vision. I felt a very odd energy brush by me, and I realized it was them. I felt panic from my sister as I knew she was behind me, and they must have surely bumped right into her. I whipped around to see her in a freeze tag-like pose. The couple were still not within peripheral sight. She was very startled and shaken, and says out loud to me, "How did I not run into them?" For she, too, had also taken some unintentional steps forward. Now, the tall duo were still walking the same direction and were about 7 or 8 feet on the other side of us heading towards the Palazzo Theater. They paused. The female looked around, but did not acknowledge us. Not at this time. And I admitted to myself that they could have not possibly be human and watched them walk away, or more like glide. Their stride was not normal. I had thought that they seemed to be communicating to each other. Now, the odd aftermath was that all we could say about the ordeal that wasn't that weird. It was as if we couldn't assimilate what had just happened. We went into the Grand Lux bar and ordered some beer, our first drink of the day, and did not speak at all. My husband joined us for a minute, and we didn't even mention it to him. And after the game, we walked to the casino across the street, and while watching the outdoor fountain show, we finally started talking about what had happened. My sister said aloud what I'd been thinking all along. We just saw aliens. We compared our stories, and they matched up. It really did happen. Is it possible that there are other reported sightings of this couple in Las Vegas, since the casinos have camera surveillance? So this person is asking, you know, thinking about ways to look at it. So basically what they're saying is this person or this couple,
yeah,
which is oddly what they're claiming, blended in or passed through them while they were walking, which almost seems like nobody else was looking at them. Like they were the only ones that were seeing this couple as they moved down through there. But it was more of like an energy wave. So it's like you're walking in a busy casino. And trust me, I understand, because it's stop and go as people were crossing through there when we were up there. But I can't imagine these people just this unnatural stroll and a glide. this woman and her sister claiming that they basically passed through them, yeah, when they crossed by.
I'm not going to say the story isn't.
I don't know
true.
How to claim. How can you claim it's an alien? I don't know.
That was what I was going to say. I was, yeah, like, yeah, it was a very unusual set of circumstances. But my first thought wouldn't be, well, obviously they're aliens. I mean, that's just, I wouldn't go there.
Yeah.
But hell, what do I know? But maybe that's what aliens look like.
I mean, I don't know what they felt. You know what I'm talking about? Like, you're not really sure what kind of energy maybe they felt. I don't know. Like I said, I don't have those empathic or whatever, you know, empaths. And like I've all said before, I'm like, I'm a dummy, so I don't feel any of that stuff. I'd just been like, hey, watch out. Sorry, don't let me spill my drink on you, you know, and that'd have been that.
Well, when it comes to mediums and empaths and stuff, it does seem like it's more traditional or more likely with women.
Yeah.
Men. You just don't see that many men that claim
many.
To be a medium.
Yeah.
I wonder what that is.
I don't know.
Is.
Maybe it seems like they're more in tune. I have no idea. I don't have any of that. Like I said, I mean, I can't tell a thing.
I can't either.
I'm an idiot.
I'm guilty as charged.
Yeah, right.
My last news article is talking about Argentina. And sticking with Argentina, I saw this the other day. There's a new case, they think, of a cattle mutilation.
Ooh.
Near the town of Concordia. It says, recently a cattleman found one of his cows dead and showing signs of a mysterious mutilation. The animal displayed unusual incisions and some parts of the body were missing. The event caused amazement among the residents of Colonia Los Sauces, Department of Concordia. The cows displayed perfect cauterized incisions on their heads and bodies with their tongue, their salivary glands extracted along with udders, rectum, and part of the large intestine and reproductive tract.
Rectum. Damn near killed them.
Right. It says the cattleman explained that the grass had become blackened at those sites where the parts had been extracted. The cattleman and owner, Gustavo Roca, spoke to elonce.com regarding the experiences on his property, which he had been unable to access for several days due to the recent amount of rains. He said, we found a dead animal, and upon inspection found it was missing its tongue and jaw, as well as the animal's rear and udders. He added that all the grass was black around where the parts were removed. Now, based on his experience, the livestock rancher noted that the animal had been dead since Sunday. Despite the presence of vultures, he said these birds of prey would not even eat it.
Mm.
Rocca also told them that his farm is some 2,000 meters distant from the local road, thus dismissing the likelihood that other persons could have been involved, adding that the rains, they've been having a lot of rains, would make it where they found the dead body impossible to reach from the road. It says the cattle rancher believes that the events on his field are related to the mysterious mutilations recorded in different areas of the province. He even said, I have seen other cases in Nueva Ecija and Puerto Yura where I've never seen one so close and so fresh. We've taken photographs and informed Abigato, which is the cattle rustling authorities, of the event. It says the incisions were very precise, and I've never seen anything like it. They say it's a mouse and that it eats those parts, but I've never seen that. And since there's mud, There was no footprints around suggesting it could be a mouse or any other animal. It says, I still wonder about what happened. I've witnessed many other cases, and now I guess it's my turn in my own field. I asked some of my cousins who live nearby if they saw anything. They said they saw nothing. It's a clean field. No one could have entered it due to the weather conditions. So once again, the cattle mutilation, you know, thing is like so many times. You find them cut apparently by lasers, it looks like. Mm-hmm. They take the tongue often. They take the rectum often. They take other body parts, the udders, the jaw. That's very common in these cattle mutilations. And this was found in a field 1,000 meters away from a road. And apparently they've been having lots of rain, so somebody would have had to have like a really good four-wheel drive vehicle even to get out there in the rain. And then there would be tracks.
No footprints. There's no tire tracks.
There's no footprints. There's no animals. Birds, like vultures and stuff, aren't touching it. Very odd.
That's very, very odd.
If you're interested in cattle mutilations, other than reading books by Linda Moulton Howe, you can listen to an episode we did with Christopher O'Brien many years ago.
He's got a great book on it, too.
Very interesting. So I thought you would like that.
That's so disturbing because it's one of those things. It's funny that you don't hear anything about them for a long time and then they start popping back up in the news. But if you talk to people, it's almost like they didn't go anywhere. They're still there. Just nobody really reports on it anymore.
Yeah, it is. And once again, much like in the story you were discussing, I'm not sure that this is extraterrestrial. I'm not sure that this has anything to do with aliens. I think it may be governments trying new things out. And it's much easier for them just abduct somebody else's animal instead of having to purchase their own. And
I don't know.
I don't know.
There's so many holes in it. Either way you think about it, you know, there's not enough to back up any theory that anybody really brings out about it.
But there definitely is cows being mutilated.
There's definitely something going on. There's corpses.
And I wonder why it always seems to be cows. Like they don't find. You never hear about goats experiencing the same thing. Horses experience burrows. It only seems to be with cows.
I don't know. Maybe it's something with the. You think it would even be pigs? I know that their skin's close to ours, stuff like that.
You would think
that it might be something along those lines, but we just don't see it that often.
Cows.
Yeah, strange. It's very strange. I've got something here because I think we're all guilty of this. This comes from NewScientist.com. Linda Geddes actually reported on this, said that late nights and lie-ins at the weekend are bad for your health. I know you're asking me, what in the hell are you talking about? Says this, that hitting the snooze button at weekends to make up for early starts during the week may be doing more harm than good. It's called social jet lag. And social jet lag occurs when your work and social commitments conflict with your innate desire to sleep at certain times. And this may increase your risk for heart disease. Now, social jet lag, they say, is basically the same thing as traveling from one time zone to another, the tiredness that you feel from it.
Yeah.
But it's a different cause. Now, Sierra Forbush at the University of Arizona in Tucson says this, that a lot of people will be waking up at 7 a.m. on weekdays, but going to bed later and sleeping in on the weekends to compensate. So, to investigate the effects of this social jet lag, Ms. Forbush's team analyzed data from 984 adults living in Pennsylvania. And to calculate how much social jet lag they experienced each week, she compared the midpoints between when people said they went to bed and woke up on weekdays and weekends. She also adjusted for how long people slept each week and whether they suffered from insomnia. And the team found that for every hour of social jet lag, there was an 11% increase in the likelihood of a person having cardiovascular disease for every hour.
I don't buy this study. I mean, how would you prove that this guy has a heart attack? Oh, it's because he has social jet lag.
You got to listen. Keep going. Hold on here. It was also linked to worse mood and increased sleepiness and fatigue. It's called the 1 hour effect. People who experience just a single hour of this social jet lag each week is equivalent to going to bed at midnight and waking up at 8 a.m. at weekends, and 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. on weekdays were 22% more likely to rate their health as good rather than excellent, and 28% more likely to rate it as fair to poor. Now, she goes on to say that physicians often tell people to think about their diet and exercise, but I think this offers an additional preventative strategy. Now, she presented this at a sleep meeting in Boston this past week and said it's not just about getting enough sleep, but getting regular sleep. Ideally, you want to be going to bed and waking up at the same time every day of the week. This isn't the first study linking social jet lag to poorer health. Almost all the hormones in your body are under circadian control. And frequently shifting your sleep and wake times causes them to fall out of sync. Now, Tammy Martino, the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, says that there are studies indicating that chronotype, a person's biological inclination towards morning or evening preference, may influence the risk of cardiovascular disease, and evening types may be more at risk. And in a separate study, also presented at the meeting, Dorothy Fisher of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health showed that people living towards the western side of U.S. time zones are more likely to be evening types, probably because the sun rises later. So indeed, for every degree you move west, people shifted about 2 minutes later, making the average distance difference between an eastern state like Maine and a western one like Indiana, both within the eastern time zone, approximately 40 minutes. That's the difference, that they may also be a higher level of social jet lag on average in such westerly states.
Social jet lag. Boy, how weak is our society becoming?
Well, what it is, it makes perfect sense. They had to put a name on it, and I think you're putting too much emphasis on the name. The idea behind it is the fact that sunlight, sunrise and sunset no longer dictates our sleep.
Yeah.
We dictate our sleep, and that's not a good thing. You're supposed to go to sleep when the sun goes down as it's dark, because that's the way it works in the photosynthesis sensors of your eyes. The same thing that drives the rut in white-tailed deer isn't temperature, it's daylight hours. And that's what tells you to rise, like we talk about. There's another study that I was going to bring up with this one, and I didn't. And they talk about people that have restless legs and restless sleeping and restless insomnia and problems really getting their rhythms back. Mm-hmm. They said that if you leave electronics alone and you were to go camping for as little as 2 days, to go camp with no electronics, rise and sleep with the sun, it will help reset your system. That you're actually healthier, not just going camping, but getting away from the electronics, much like you're not supposed to sleep with your phone by you, any of that stuff. But also, you think about it, it makes sense. If you stay on a schedule, if you go into bed a little earlier and getting up earlier, once your body gets set to that schedule, it's what throws it off. They also talk about people that aren't, their health suffers when they work night shifts because the human body is not meant to work all night long and sleep during the daylight hours.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's a whole big study that they're doing, that they're coming out with all this. It's like, you know, you need to keep the same, because I think what it is, you know, everybody works so hard during the week, then they want to go party on the weekends, and it's more than just being run down, because I also know that there are times, no matter what we do, if you stay up late, even just watching movies, and you try to sleep in, and then comes Monday, you still feel tired.
Yeah.
Whereas there's times on the weekends where you go to bed early, you get up early, and you do some stuff, and you work, and then you go to bed early, and you get up, and you're back at work, and you don't feel as tired. And that's weird. Like we always talk about, you always feel, sometimes when you sleep too long, you feel overtired. Like I don't feel rested. I feel worse than I did.
Yeah.
It's because your body's not in that sync that it's supposed to be in. I think that's odd. Another thing that I find odd, folks, that we're going to get into is missing people. So when we come back from the break, I'm going to be discussing a few cases of missing hunters. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we are back and ready to roll. It's something that I've wanted to talk about for a while. It's interesting cases. There's numerous interesting cases. Kyle and I have discussed this before. We've had people on talking about this. It's just a real wild thing to think about, of these missing hunters and anybody missing. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a hunter, just anybody that goes missing. And I guess I need to start this segment off by saying that this is one of the most disturbing topics I feel we have ever covered.
It is bizarre because you don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that, but the frequency,
mm-hmm.
like the sheer numbers of people that are actually going missing.
When you go
and the fact that
it,
the authorities almost, you know, not only do they not keep track of it, it's almost like they don't want to acknowledge it's even happening, which mm-hmm. to me stands out as, looks, they know something's going on. Why wouldn't they be keeping track? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's creepy.
You start reading missing 411 books.
I wish I never had, because ever since I read one, now every time I go camping, I literally will have a moment or two where I start thinking about,
yeah,
Should I let the brood go off without me watching them?
Yeah.
Things like that. Because you, and then you're like, stop it. You're crazy, Kyle. Nothing is going to happen. But that's what all these people thought. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
We've even had people that were featured in some of David's books that have emailed the show and told us about, like, this book, this chapter, he talked about my son.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, so you're like, man, it is real, but that's what makes it so hard. You know, when compared to Chupacabras and these outlandish stories, this is something very real and very disturbing.
It's got far-reaching implications as far as when you start looking at, like you're talking about, the people involved. It could be federal, it could be, you know, any kind of local, state, even, you know, regional, county, any kind of local government. There seems to be something definitely going on that some are privy to the information and some are not. That's what's so strange about it. And I guess my reason for saying this is because this topic is the one that I can relate to the most. I consider myself an outdoorsman. I've spent most of my life in the woods. I've been on many hunting trips that have taken me through multiple states. I've done multiple day solo camping trips. I still have more planned to go do, folks. And I say all this because today we're going to be looking at some of the people that have vanished under the strange circumstances, all while hunting and camping, all while doing what we love to do. I think as a mainly modern culture today, it's hard for us to imagine a life without the modern comforts, such as running water, electricity, heat, air conditioning, and even food at our fingertips. But for some, we miss the idea of sleeping under the stars and having the daylight and the seasons dictate our lives, that we yearn for the adventure of testing ourselves daily with chores such as food and water procurement, even the building of shelter, and so on. All of this we take upon ourselves with the only payment as being able to witness stunning sunrises and sunsets, beautiful starry skies, and breathtaking vistas on our horizon. The people we're about to discuss all had this gene. All of them had this sense of adventure that modern life wasn't quenching. The first person we're going to start off discussing is Jerry Lee McCohen. Just 2 miles north of the California border sits the town of Merrill, Oregon. It was this beautiful town where Mr. Jerry Lee McCohen worked the family business as a rancher and a farmer. Jerry was very close to his family and loved the outdoors, being brought up to respect it and enjoy its bounty. The people who knew Jerry all said that he was a very experienced hunter and enjoyed the challenge so much that he had given up on rifle hunting years before and now only used a bow and arrows. The challenge of archery was something that Jerry loved. So, on the cool morning of Saturday, September 21st, in 2002, Jerry, being single and having no one but himself to answer to, threw his gear into the camper that covered the bed of his old GMC pickup, checked the straps in the camper that was tying down his Honda 185 XL dirt bike, and headed out to one of his favorite spots to go, the backcountry of California. Jerry had picked up the dirt bike so he could use it to get through the rougher backcountry and so it wouldn't wear him out as much as hiking would. Well, after Jerry didn't return the next day, the family got a little worried, but figured he was having good luck and decided to stay an extra day. It was after the fourth day of not hearing from Jerry that his parents and friends decided to file a missing persons report. The report was filed on September 25th, and the news ran like wildfire through the close-knit community. The ranchers and farmers that neighbored the area dropped all that they were doing and joined up to help search for Jerry. One of Jerry's hunting buddies thought he knew where Jerry had gone and headed out there, headed to Christmas Valley and then over to Klamath Marsh to find his friend. No such luck. Jerry wasn't there. Another friend finally located Jerry's truck and dirt bike only 20 miles east of the famed Mount Shasta. It was in an area referred to as Doorknob Park, on a dirt road called Medicine Lake Road. And that friend started inspecting the truck, looking around to see if he could see maybe foul play or any clues as to where Jerry was. The friend walked to the back of the truck, got down on his knees, and reached under the rear bumper on the driver's side by the taillight and found Jerry's keys tucked in the little area there, knowing that's where Jerry always put them when he headed out on a hunting trip. And that's when the friend instantly became worried, knowing now it wasn't foul play, but that likely an accident that had delayed his hunting buddy. The Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office was contacted about the vehicle, and the search was put into motion. 70 searchers descended upon this area, along with 2 teams of search dogs, 4 airplanes, and 2 FLIR-equipped helicopters, the forward-looking infrared. The area was gridded off for searching, and over 100 people hit that land on foot. Now, this area isn't known for super rough terrain or towering trees and timber. No, in fact, it's almost the opposite. This area is relatively easy traversing and has small timber, but thick, low brush to contend with. Several days of 24-hour searching went by. Nothing. Several of Jerry's close friends and hunting companions came forward and voiced that Jerry was seasoned in the woods and knew how to handle anything this country could throw at him. They were all dumbfounded as there was no evidence that he'd ever even been in this area. The Siskiyou County SAR team, search and rescue, said that when someone becomes injured, they will start dropping or shedding gear. But there was nothing here. They also found no animals that might have been harvested while hunting. When the search was called off for Jerry, there was no more answers than the day they started searching. It was said that it was like the ground opened up and swallowed any trace of Jerry. The searchers couldn't understand how, between the FLIR on the choppers and the noses on the dogs, that nothing of Jerry was ever located. Mr. Jerry Lee McCohen is still missing to this day. Now, this next case I'd like to share gives me the uneasy feeling that someone involved with search knows more than they have said. And this is the case of Mr. Richard Harkins. You see, Richard is a hard-working Minnesota man whom loved the outdoors. So much so that he made it his career. Richard, you see, was a sales rep for a motorcycle and snowmobile company. Loved his job, which made him really good at it. He was a good-hearted fellow and, according to his friends, a very experienced hunter and woodsman. And, of course, like all hunters, looking forward to this elk season, an excited Richard Harkins set out in early September 2015 for the beautiful Steamboat Springs, Colorado. He met up in Denver with 3 hunting buddies, and they all struck out to Steamboat Springs to make camp in the Route National Forest, just a mere 22 air miles now from Steamboat Springs. They picked a beautiful scenic area near Sand Mountain, just west of Steamboat Lake, to make their camp. It was Sunday, September 6th, when they pitched their tents and strung up their tarps, hoisted the food cans into the trees to keep the bears out of camp, and settled in for what they hoped would be a great elk season. Lying in their tents and hearing the bugling of the bull elk as they call for their harem of cows can make for sleepless nights filled with excitement. Trust me when I say this, because I've been there. And when daylight broke the next morning, Richard's buddies were up and ready to head out. But Richard wasn't feeling that great. Maybe the jet lag from travel, maybe the altitude, or even the restless sleep. But he told his pals to go ahead and that he'd head out in a few hours. So they all agreed And then the three made their way out onto the mountain, chasing their quarry. It is believed by his friends that were there that day, and they'd also given in statements, that Richard left camp around 7:30 that morning, and then later that day even texted one of his hunting buddies about the day. But that would be the last time anyone would ever hear from Richard again. When his friends started arriving back at camp that evening, well, they thought nothing of his delayed arrival, believing he may have gotten one and was simply making his way back to camp after locating his game. As the hours stretched into deep darkness, the men became worried for Richard's safety. And on sturdy, confident legs, his friends donned their headlamps, grabbed their lanterns, and headed out into the darkness, calling Richard's name and frantically searching for their friend. After searching all night with no luck, at day break in the mornings, second morning of the men, well, they headed out, two of them, to the sheriff's office to try to find help. One stayed back in case Richard showed back up. Richard was reported missing on September 7th, 2015, and the Rout County Sheriff's Office, led by Undersheriff Ray Birch, well, they responded there in full force. Professional SAR teams responded as well, and multiple volunteers, two search dogs and three helicopters, again, all equipped with FLIR. Now, during an interview given to the Steamboat Today newspaper, Undersheriff Ray Birch said about the dogs that this, on Thursday, two search dogs from Grand County were brought in to help. They had a pretty strong scent indication, which is consistent with the direction of travel, which is southwest of Sand Mountain. He went on to shine a little more detail on this, saying that Richard's scent was found along Armstrong Creek, headed towards California Park. All the searchers and dogs and helicopters found nothing of any significance, and it wasn't one of the professionals that would put the family at rest, but a normal, untrained volunteer that would find Richard's body. And not in some deep crevasse where one might fall in the dark trying to make his way back to camp, and not miles from camp where he had gotten lost and exposure and thirst had taken its toll and caused an unprepared man to die. No, it wasn't anything like that. Richard was found along U.S. Forest Road 40, a mere 200 yards from his camp. Passed over by his friends, passed over by professional SAR members, three helicopters, and trained canine units. After being taken to the coroner's office, it took several weeks for the Rout County coroner and his office to understand what killed Richard. And several weeks later, all they could come up with was altitude sickness. How did all involved miss such an obviously close body? That's the main question. This one that I'm about to discuss, I thought was extremely interesting due to the history this person was involved in, but also the size and depth of the search. This disappearance takes place in 1930, but the story starts much earlier than that. In the town of Malden, Massachusetts, there was a company called the Converse Rubber Company. And in 1917, it introduced the wonderful Converse Canvas All-Star, one of the first basketball shoes anywhere in the world. And in 1921, a Mr. Charles Taylor joined their sales team and, better known to his friends as Chuck, helped the company take their shoes to the next level. In 1929, Converse was struggling like everywhere else in this country and had to file for bankruptcy. The president of the Converse Rubber Company at this time had also been the president of the Hodgman Rubber Company since 1925. This fella's name was Mitchell Kaufman. Mitchell was a very driven and intelligent 37-year-old man. He loved sports and the business of leading a company, but his true passion was the outdoors. So, in November of 1930, Mitchell met up with four friends from Boston, and the group headed out to northwestern Maine to do some deer hunting. Mitchell had hired two guides from the area, Neil Rancourt and Levi Kennedy. Now Mitchell and the guys had gotten some nice little cabins near Crocker Pond and was looking forward to having a bro trip, if you will. And on November 4th, the weather was brutally cold, and the guides, of course, not feeling that they were earning their money, tried to get the guys to get out and go hunting. Instead of hiking around in the cold, the men were just content with playing cards and drinking whiskey and enjoying just getting away and catching up. So the guides, they worked on them some more, and finally, the next day, Mr. Neil Rancourt finally talked Mitchell into leaving the cabin and going after some deer. So, on November 5th, Mitchell and Neil headed out in search of some whitetail. Now, due to the age of this story, there are a few discrepancies, such as this, that it's not known 100% sure if Neil and Mitchell took the small boat that was tied out there that the guides had and crossed the lake and then split up to search for deer or even do a push, or if they both crossed over or walked around, however they got there, and then became separated due to the weather. Several stories blend here. We're not sure 100%, but what is known is this. Mitchell Kaufman never returned. And immediately, the group started searching. Now, they wasted no time in alerting the authorities, and they all began looking. And of course, as luck would have it, on the second day of the search, winds and freezing rain blanketed the area, making tracking of any individual even more difficult. During this search, the cold hours dragged on, and slowly hours turned into days, and still no luck. Two professional guides, skilled in bushcraft and tracking, and one of them, knowing where to even start looking, still couldn't find Mitchell. Well, soon, Converse headquarters got involved and started to organize a larger search group, as well as using their clout to put a little pressure on state politicians to make sure nothing was spared in the search for Mitchell. It's not what you know, folks, it's who you know to get things done. And knowing exactly what rubber boots that Mitchell was wearing that he was hunting in also helped the guides know what tracks had merit and those that did not. Now, these guides knew that he could survive, they believed anyway, because there were loads of small game for easy meals all around, and also fresh water everywhere you looked. And the guides also knew Mitchell was carrying, at the time of his disappearance, a compass and matches. Searchers tried everything, see. They built large brush piles for bonfires on the high spots and ridges all in this area. And they set them on fire, flames leaping into the air in hopes that Mitchell would see them and head to the flames. There was also signaling shots fired in the air, thinking that maybe Mitchell could hear these shots and either come to the sound or would return fire, as he was also carrying a rifle. No luck on that either. It was being reported this was the biggest manhunt in the state's history, and that searchers had crisscrossed so much of that region that no one could understand where he had gone. The sheriff even brought in bloodhounds to help track, and he believed that Mitchell might have moved out of the search area and that possibly that they should expand their area of operation. And in addition to manpower, Converse themselves sent two search planes and an amphibious plane. so the sheriff could use whenever he felt, and those planes flew in non-stop search patterns looking for Mitchell. Converse even went on to pay registered searchers that were involved in this little operation $3 to $5 a day in hopes of enticing more skilled help to look for Mitchell. The sheriff himself even went so far as to get the Canadian police involved and had them drop their border requirements. And they helped as searchers formed, now get this, arm widths apart skirmish lines and pushed through the brush across the country looking for any sign of Mitchell. Now, having some strange luck with the dogs and the bloodhounds not being able to follow a scent more than a mile in one direction, that was leading the sheriff to think that maybe they'd gone the wrong way. See, for 3 weeks, the search had been grinding on, day and night. They covered the border of Canada down to the far western Maine and had nothing to show for their efforts. The sheriff and searchers were beaten and broken and completely lost as to where Mitchell could have gone. Switching from believing that this was a missing hunter case, the sheriff, Elton Markham, started thinking this possibly could be foul play. So on December 12th, he had the four friends of Mitchell come back to town for interrogation. The two guides were also questioned at length, and all six came back with the exact same story. Now you see, Mitchell was single, but his brother-in-law was a very close friend of his, and so the family put him in charge of all the search efforts and anything related to Mitchell's disappearance. His name was Albert Weschler. And he was the right man for the job. Albert paid great attention to detail and vowed to never rest until he found Mitchell alive or dead. But either way, he was getting this family answers. And after studying the search grid maps and patterns of the searchers, Albert hired several local seasoned guides and trackers. And in May of 1931, they headed into an area that was on the outside edge of the search area. An area that had not been searched at the time because it was believed to be rough and too far, and surely no one would have traveled into that area. On May 19th, 1931, it was reported in the paper that 9 miles from Croker Pond and the cabins the men were staying in, on top of brush pile, left arm across his chest, right arm by his side, the fully clothed body of Mr. Mitchell Kaufman was found. There were no signs of violence to the body, no signs of predation to the body. And who was it that found the body, you ask? The right man for the job, and his close friend and brother-in-law, Albert. They never found Mitchell's rifle, and could not understand why he went the direction he did when he had a compass and knew the direction of the roads and the camp from where he was. They don't know why he didn't try to light a fire, and that even in those conditions, it was possible. Also, why was he atop a brush pile and not under it for shelter? There was nothing written on the speculation of Mitchell's death, but only that numerous fires atop hillsides, 4 guides, several dozen resource officers and game wardens, 3 search planes, 7 dog teams, and roughly 800 searchers couldn't find Mitchell Kaufman 9 miles from camp. It took the sole focus of family to close his story. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. You know, this is exactly what I was talking about before you got into it.
Yeah.
Is, you know, not just the fact that these are experienced outdoorsmen. These are guys that are hunters. They know what to do in situations when it comes to, you know, camping, spending the night in the woods, procuring water, mm-hmm. making a fire, making shelter. Not only do they know how to do that, but these guys are all exploring and hunting in areas that they're already familiar with.
Yes.
So what is going on?
Well, it's weird to me because you always think of an outdoorsman as someone that hunts, but that's not necessarily true. You do some research, you look at all these people that do through hikes, through the AT, through the PCT, the Continental Divide. You look at the ultralight backpackers and kayakers and fishermen that do all these long distance trips and all this. All these people are seasoned, and that's what the word usually comes from, seasoned in bushcraft and woodsmanship and things, to where you know how to build a fire and you have multiple ways of making it if things get bad. That didn't change back then. That was all still the same thing. So everyone knows safety. Now, yeah, you can say there's accidents happen, and they do happen. But when you're raised in this, and I think anyone that was, I can speak for most everybody that's ever been raised as far as like this with the hunting and fishing and the outdoors and all that stuff is, you're raised with an extra respect because you know that one mistake can cost you your life or someone else is with you. If you have a mistake with a firearm, you've killed yourself or someone with you. If you have a mistake with a knife or a bow, you've killed yourself or someone with you. If you have an accident and you break a leg, so you have to be extra cautious while you're out there. So you don't get complacent. Now, you can say everybody does. Not necessarily, because you have to stay on top of your game. You know, that's just how it is out there, or accidents will happen. And those can cost you and usually do cost you your life when a troublesome accident happens. So you start looking into this stuff. These men were all seasoned into this whole thing. Jerry Lee McCohen was 48 years old. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Mitchell, 37. Richard, 43. So we're all talking about guys roughly close to our age that go out there. You're in good shape. This is what you do. This is what you've always done. And then now something happens. Now, look, I can completely understand in the snow and in the cold. And you bring up into Colorado, for those of you that aren't usually familiar with anything, especially in the U.S. or whatnot, in September, there's not always snow. I mean, I was doing some elk hunting in September in New Mexico. Now, it's way up in the mountains, and it was cold in the mornings, but there was no snow. I mean, in certain areas at really high elevations, yeah, but it's not like you couldn't just go down the mountain a little bit and get out of the snow. There's fresh water. There's things to eat. You know, I was always taught you never kill a porcupine, ever, when you're out there, because porcupines are survival food, because they don't run away from you. So if you ever have to survive on one, you can walk up and kill it with a stump. I mean, you
right.
can hit it with something, things like that. Little things that you always think of. Now, yeah, there's exposure and stuff, but usually if you go downhill, you're going to get into warmer air, things as that nature. So you're dealing with people that live in it. We don't even live in the mountains, and there's things that we already know to be prepared for. These are people that are used to living in that weather and in those mountains, and they're prepared. And look, yes, Mitchell's was from the 1930s, okay? Jerry Lee's was from 2002. Richard's was from 2015. It's not like he's running around out there with some real cheap tennis shoes on or something, you know, some just regular old rubber boots and a t-shirt. No, these people are prepared. So what happens? What happens in Jerry Lee's case? He's out there near Mount Shasta, mind you. His truck and everything, he didn't use any of that. He's parked it and walked out and just vanished. They don't know if he walked 100 feet and vanished or 100 miles and vanished. All they found was his truck and his gear, and that's it.
I know, that's...
Gone.
Man, gone. I don't understand.
The thing that I don't understand the most is Richard's case. 200 yards from camp.
Yeah.
200 yards from camp. Dogs, mind you. Fleer, mind you. All this, and look, I understand. If you're dead, you're probably not going to give off a heat signature, you know, after, especially overnight, as your body's cooled, more than likely you're going to blend in. But you would think that within 24 hours, unless there was something drastically done, you would, and they say he died from altitude sickness. What is that? I mean, how would you die? I mean, I understand of being maybe dehydrated, things. Would you have a heart attack and die, an aneurysm and die? I mean, when did he die after? If he left at 7:30 and sent a text message, let's just play devil's advocate here. Let's say he sent a text message around lunch to his buddies.
Right.
So he died right after that point would be the only way he died, because by the time they alerted everybody, they looked all night, mind you, never found him. They went back the next morning and got the sheriffs. I don't understand why they didn't go right then and go get him whenever he was gone, but they decided to do it themselves the next morning, and they get everything launched up. It wouldn't quite be 24 hours. I could see if he died from something like an aneurysm or a heart attack or something like that, and his body cooled and all this, they couldn't find it. But dogs are going to find you. They're going to find you. Here's something that's really odd. The dogs didn't go in the direction of where they found Richard. The dogs went in the opposite direction. And it goes back into the stories that David's talked about and we've discussed, is whenever they seem to find them dropped like bodies face down in the middle of an area that has been looked at and scoured over multiple times.
By search teams.
Yes.
They would have seen them, but they weren't there in the original search or the second search. Yeah. And then on day five, they find them
right there. Exactly.
They're like, 100 yards from where we started our search on day one. There's no way all of us, the dogs, everything would have missed them.
No, there's no way. Look, there's always room for error. It's just the way everything is, but not like that. These people are professionals.
Seems too much to be a stretch.
Yeah.
And I've heard different, you know, theories out there that it's a serial killer operating in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to believe all that, but like I said, you've got to be somebody with a lot of conviction if you think, I'm not just going to kill people. I'm going to go after guys that are hunting.
That are armed.
Because these people are armed sometimes with bow and arrow, sometimes with a rifle, handgun, knives. I mean, that is a challenge.
Yeah.
And they're, like we always talk about, whoever's doing it is batting 1,000.
It's the predator.
It almost seems that way.
Right, it does. Well, here's another thing that sprang up during the Mitchell Kaufman story. In his case, is that they're in Maine. There are a lot of black bears in Maine.
Uh-huh.
You would think there would be bear predation on his corpse.
But none.
Some sort. None. There was no bear. No. He's laying on top of a brush pile. Now, the thing that's hard to find is they didn't go into how tattered his clothing was. Like, was it still, you know, relatively new? What did his boots look like? They didn't go into any of that. But what are you doing laying on top of a brush pile and nothing comes and drags you off and chews on you?
Yeah, I don't have any explanation.
You know, I mean, how is that, you know? Now, look, I can understand if it was cold and maybe it got snowed on and it froze his body and there was no smell. You know, I could get that. But you would think that they would still be ground squirrels or field mice or birds or something. But it's almost like nothing touched him until they found him.
And then the scariest thing is that there's hundreds of these stories that you didn't cover, hundreds, or didn't bring up. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot more than you would really think. And I'm sure almost everyone listening to this is familiar with David and his work. No, I still have not seen the new documentary, although I know it's out. I don't think you can stream it. I think you have to order a DVD, Blu-ray, or normal, and then it's mailed to you. I've seen several people asking me about it. We were not sent a copy, even though we contributed a lot of money to the Kickstarter.
That's true.
But no, we haven't had a chance. Even if I did have it here, I don't know if I've had time to watch it yet, but I do plan on watching it at some point. And if you're interested in things like missing people, there's not a set of books I would suggest to you stronger than the Missing 411 series. And all of his books are good, but I still have to say my favorite are his first two, the one that's in the Western United States and the other one's about the Eastern United States. Those two, to me, are my favorite, you know, compared to the others. But they're all very good. Very good. Before we get out of here, let's talk about our proud sponsors. I'd like to remind you about Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. You can go over there. This is a video streaming service with over 7,000 titles. They got some great sections over there. They have sections on yoga, transformation, and under there, you know, they talk about spiritual growth, alternative health, personal development. They also have Seeking Truth section, which has original programs and metaphysics, secrets and cover-ups, ancient origins, the paranormal, and unexplained. And they have some great shows over there, like Open Minds with Regina Meredith. They have Cosmic Disclosure with Corey Good and David Wilcock, Missing Links with Greg Braden, Beyond Belief with George Norrie, Hidden Origins with Michael Tellinger, and Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe, and much, much more. If you want to have access to this, you have to go over to Gaia. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. And they got a couple different plans you can sign up for. The monthly plan, if their first month now, if you sign up, is 99 cents. After that, it'll be $9.95. They have a 3-month plan that's $20. And they also have an annual plan that's $95.40 for the entire year. I know several friends that have this service and they love it. I love it.
Oh,
they got
dozens
outside of those shows, this original programming. They also have movies, they have films, they have documentaries, and you know, all this stuff is ad-free, and we're so glad that they're a sponsor of Expanded Perspectives. Trust me, if you like our show and the stuff we discuss, you're going to like Gaia. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Also, another great sponsor is Dollar Shave Club.
And it's so great. I'm glad you brought it up, and I'm glad they're sponsors of the show, folks. Don't forget, when you sign up with them, /expanded, dollarshaveclub.com/expanded, your first month. You get the shave butter, and it's all for $5. You get free shipping, the whole thing. It's great. It's a great, great thing to have.
I love it.
I love it. I use it more than it. I find myself shaving my head more than I used to because I like using the shave butter and I like using their razors.
Yeah, it's an amazing product. Don't forget, that's expanded. I mean, dollarshaveclub.com/expanded. And, you know, these two companies that are sponsoring the show, they allow us to bring you the show for free because, unfortunately, it's not free to produce. Cam, what do you got planned for your weekend?
Man, oh, man, I'm not sure. There's a few movies that I want to go see. Went and watched Wonder Woman this weekend.
Oh, how was that?
Great. I love that movie. It was really a wonderful movie.
The trailer looked really good.
They did a great, great. If you liked the original Captain America, the very first Captain America, you're going to like Wonder Woman just as much.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So there's some other ones coming out that I want to go see. Like, what's it called? It Comes at Night. I want to go check that out.
I saw that in that where, like, it looks like a drunken chick is drooling blood into the mouth of a guy sleeping in his bed.
We've all been there. I mean, come on, it's no big deal. So
yeah, I've had that happen.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Who hasn't? Anyhow, it looked like somebody had been drinking too much Mad Dog. That's what it looked like to me. I don't think
Boone's
it was blood.
Farm.
That's right. A little strawberry here. Drool.
Please don't. You've never drank Night Train.
Oh, man, that's bringing back bad memories. But yeah, so I don't know, man. I don't know what I'm going to do. At least, but I am going to check on some movies, check on some of that. Maybe play a little disc golf. It all depends. It just depends on how the weather works out this week. I got a lot of work to catch up on.
That's me, too. I've got a lot of work to do. I've got meetings with the CPA. That's always fun, finding out what
you Why'd you got to bring that up? I don't want to. Man, I forgot about that.
Baseball tournaments and things like that. If you have a story of your own you'd like to share with Expanded Perspectives, don't forget you can email us, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show, 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media. And I hope everybody out there has a really great week. For you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Friday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you again next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.